Okay, thanks very much, Suzanne, and thank you to you and Roman and the other organisers for inviting us here. I think one apology is in order, which is this really doesn't have too much to do with molecules, so I apologise for that. A compensating factor is it probably will be fairly short. So, particularly in the light of the slightly congested schedule this week, maybe people may appreciate brevity. Okay, so it talks about inspirities of light and atoms in 1D. 1D is actually not just because one dimension is sometimes easier to make calculations in, or because in a sense it's particularly exotic, but actually has some practical motivation. As Suzanne indicated, this is work by both of us. I happen to have drawn the short straw in terms of giving the talk. And this is a picture of where we come from. That's
for me.
Of course, the nicest building is always the one that the administrators are in. So in terms of motivation, obviously many people have worked on problems where, as well as the atoms showing interesting behavior, the light can as well. One thinks particularly recently of work by people like Tillman Esslinger and his group, looking at Dickey transitions and other symmetry breaking transitions in 2D cavities. What we're going to do is a little bit different to that, but nevertheless make some contact with the history of that subject. So, as I said, this talk is about something where the light is not just a kind of dictator that tells the atoms where to go, but is also something which is influenced by what the atoms are doing. So it's a rather more democratic situation that often is true when one thinks about, for example, optical lattices. The simplest case where such a thing has been seen is actually almost prehistoric by the standards of this field, which was worked by Bill Phillips and his group almost 20 years ago. And what they showed was that as you loaded an optical lattice, obviously the lasers were locked to a certain frequency, but as you loaded the lattice, so in effect the refractive index of the medium changed, the wavelength of the optical lattice actually changed, although the effect was quite small. And they observed this, and they also in fact observed that if you then sent in a probe beam of light and where you could alter its frequency, you could explore the fact there were actually there was an optical band structure, for example, generated by this periodic dielectric medium, which is the atom sitting in the optical lattice. So that's that was one of the first examples where the light was affected by the presence of the atoms rather than just the other way around. A little bit more recent than that, but again quite a long time ago, at least the start of it, was the realization in terms of work by Ketterly's group and by other people, Philip Kurtai and also Letich's group, that in fact the light could again be altered by pattern formation. So if you took some atoms with initially a beam of light fired at the atoms in one direction, then in general you got some backscattering of that light. The backscattered light then, because of the interference with the initial beam, started to generate more or less desirable places for the atoms to sit. The atoms moved to those places. The atoms then scattered the light more, and this whole thing reinforced itself. And this was studied, again, almost 10 years ago, the first time in these papers here. And in a way, both of these two cases will have a bearing on what we're going to talk about. So it's not so much related to the more recent work by Esslinger and others, but perhaps a little bit more a continuation of these two lines of thought. So let me now come to the kind of practical motivation for this. One of the things that there's been quite a bit of interest in, initially purely in the optical community over the last decade or so, is to have optical fibers which don't operate in the conventional way. In a conventional optical fiber, you normally have the refractive index in the center of the fiber larger and the refractive index diminishing as you go out. So the light undergoes total internal reflection that's confined in the fiber. For kind of reasons to do with how to do this, achieve this with high optical powers, people realized that maybe you could build optical fibers which were hollow, And then it sounds rather paradoxical because the refractive index seems the wrong way around to give internal reflection. But the way you can find the beam in the hole is actually by having Bragg mirrors around the hole in the fiber. So the beam is confined by Bragg reflection interference rather than by a geometrical optical process. And as soon as these fibers were first constructed in about 1999, people wondered whether you couldn't also then transport things down the fibers. So given there was a hole that the light was going down, couldn't you use the radiation pressure to drive particles down the hole, and moreover perhaps use the radiation mode through the dipole force to confine the particles away from the walls? So that idea occurred very quickly. And in fact, in 2002, the first experiments were done to demonstrate micron-sized particles being moved down in the fibers. And sorry, I should have said, here we're actually going to be talking about not pattern formation, but pattern destruction and stability. So if you like, the converse of what the people are talking about there. Okay, so so photonic fibers are these things. The first paper was this one in 1999. The figure I'm going to show comes from a slightly more recent work, which was in 2003 by Giannopoulos and people like that. And this is a composite picture where one has a picture of the fiber. Here, the Bragg reflection comes from a kind of concentric cylindrical set of interfaces. The scales are roughly a micron for everything you can see in that picture. And so the idea is you get total internal reflection because of Bragg reflection from this periodic structure. And it works very well, actually. Even in those days, people were talking about being able to transmit signals over tens to hundreds of kilometers. So it's quite a good unlossy mode of transport of radiation. And the interesting thing from our point of view is that this diagram, it's based on dispersion relations. Here's the wave vector along normal to that picture along the fiber, and here's the frequency. What one observes is the blue regions are regions where there are modes which propagate, which can carry energy out of the fiber. So those are ones which are not confining. But there are quite large regions of this picture where, in fact, there are modes which are completely evanescent. There are no propagating modes laterally. And hence, one can think of these modes as being rather well confined within the fiber. And indeed, if you have, I think the numbers I remember being quoted were, if you had perhaps 10 to 50 of these layers, you really did a very good job. And that was a measure of figure of merit, was this issue about you could propagate for tens of hundreds of kilometers. So this is, if you like, a picture of the thing which light moves in a one-dimensional manner. There are only discrete modes for each wave vector. So clearly, if one starts to think about things like spontaneous emission, they're in a rather different way in this sort of realm. And moreover, the modes can be quite well separated. So this is the kind of frequency in units, roughly, of the frequency of the laser you're propagating.
How many photons do you lose per kilometer?
Well, I guess it's when they say they can propagate 100 kilometers, they mean they lose, you know, it's E or something, it's E to the minus one. So it's quite impressive. What the figure is in dBs per kilometer, I can't quote you that, I'm afraid. But and these are much better than glass capillary. I mean, there was some older work where people looked at hollow glass capillaries. But there are all sorts of problems with specular reflection or non-specular reflection and loss and so on.
And this is classical light, basically, right?
This is classical light, yeah. I mean, of course, you could think about photons. I mean, there are interesting things there.
You could send one photon
down the fiber. Yeah, no, you could send one photon. In fact, I'll come on to the work that people have done in this in the context of atoms in a moment, but indeed, one of the great things about this is because the radiation is confined, it's actually quite easy to get into nonlinear regimes with rather low light intensities. And that's one of the reasons people are interested in sticking atoms down these things, is to have weak nonlinear optics. So
you cover it through mirrors on both sides and you've got some sort of a cavity.
Quite right, yeah. And a very long cavity, perhaps. So that's one of the themes here. Well, of course, making enough cooled atoms to generate a kilometer's worth might be a challenge, but you're going in the right direction. I mean, one of the issues here is length scales and how different physics occurs depending on how big the thing is.
So for these guys, you need interference, as you said, right?
Yeah, the interference occurs laterally. That's why that you get confinement.
Right, but if you start thinking about photons, so how you So it's going to interfere with itself?
Yeah, no, that's fine. You get a single particle wave equation, which is band gaps. You can just have one photon obeying that. Sorry, has it got... What's going on?
Oh dear, yes.
It's okay. Thank you. So there's no problem with that in terms of a single photon experiencing Bragg reflection. I think that's the difficulty. Anyway, so the point here, the message really to take away is that you get pretty good confinement in 1D in this sort of in this white regime where you don't get leaky modes, and moreover the number of modes is pretty discrete. And so once one thinks about spontaneous emission, it's a warning that things may be a bit different from the way you think about it in free space. Okay. So this was the statement that you can get 100 kilometer propagation, and the regions with the non-radiated losses are these white ones. And you can make the losses very, very good. I mean, very, very small indeed. So as I said, people thought about loading things down these fibers almost immediately after invented, and Philip Russell, who was the inventor, in fact, already sent micron-sized particles down them 10 years before the work quoted here. But now he's got to the stage last summer of being able to transmit things several meters down these fibers. So obviously, in a BEC context, you start to worry, or not worry, wonder whether you can't have remote contact between BECs, possibly in large length scales. There is the issue of how you fill it all with atoms, and maybe you have to do it in some time-dependent pulse mode. But you start to wonder whether there might be interesting things to explore there. So coming down to atomic things rather than micron-sized things, people have put hot and cold atoms into fibers, starting off back in 2006. This is a more recent piece of work from the MIT group, from Lukin's group. And even people have shown that you can get them to the other side, and here are a couple of pieces of work here. But in general, it's proved to be a bit harder than people thought to do this, and certainly no one to my knowledge has managed to get a BEC inside an optical fiber yet. And there may be some connection between that difficulty and what we'll talk about in a minute. But people are thinking more ingenious ways of making very gradually sloping funnels to try and help the BEC get in a more adiabatic way if there are problems with non-adiabaticity and so on. But nevertheless, at the moment, the state of the art is basically you can certainly put atoms in. These people are largely interested in low-intensity nonlinear optics. You can also transport things, but probably not BECs yet. Okay, so we are now going to ask, well, what happens if you could get a B and C in there? And would it be stable? Wouldn't it be stable? How is it different from what happens in the ordinary three-dimensional world with no confinement? And we're going to deal with the light and the atoms in an even-handed way. We're going to deal with them in the mean field way. So it's, if you like, Gross-Podolsky for the bosons, and it's Maxwell's equations for the photons. Albeit in a scalar manifestation, because we're only going to deal with one mode. And they're going to be coupled to each other. And of course, the interest comes from that coupling. The coupling comes from the fact that the atoms like to sit in regions of large electric field squared, assuming they're red detuned. And on the other hand, the photons, or the light, sees a modulation in the refractive index as the density varies. So the two things are coupled to each other, and our aim will be to look at these coupled equations and see under what conditions they're stable and what conditions they're not, and maybe try and understand why they are stable or not unstable or unstable. So the representation we're going to use is not Gross-Podolsky in its sort of most straightforward form, but we're going to use the hydrodynamic equations. So this is all standard stuff. The only difference really is, this is Bernoulli, if you like, with the quantum pressure terms. This is the continuity equation. The only interesting term really is this thing. This is the thing which embodies the coupling to the electric field. There's a bit of scaling going on in terms of normalizing density to its average value. S is the, so this is the so-called Madelung representation, psi equals root rho e to the is. So S is the velocity potential. And I'm going to define what alpha prime does in a moment. Here we are. Alpha prime is basically the depth of the potential from the optical lattice scaled by, or the optical field scaled by the chemical potential. So it's something like a half the polarizability of an atom times the electric field strength squared divided by G, where G is the appropriate coupling constant, and Gross-Podersky times the density. So it's that ratio. So it's how dominant is the influence of the electric field to do with a laser compared to the interactions between the particles that determine the chemical potential. And we are going to work predominantly in a limit where this is weak. So this parameter here will be small. So this is not a strong optical lattice. It's going to be a weak optical lattice where the deviation of the BC from uniformity will be moderately small. And that allows us to say things which are quite hard to say. In
the short, what is the electric field profile look like?
Well, initially, I'm going to look at two different cases. One is where one only has initially one single beam, so it's a plane wave, and the BEC is also initially uniform, and then we're going to ask if there are, in the time domain, instabilities to that. In the second case, we're going to do a lattice, so there'll be two beams.
Because I'm wondering, you know, like...
Do you mean the lateral profile?
Yeah.
Again, the idea with the fiber is that you use the dipole force to confine the atoms away from the walls. Of course, there will be some losses due to things sticking to walls, but the higher the power, the better, of course, for that. At the center, yeah, no, we're using a mode where the intensity is the highest down the middle. So nothing, we're not doing, because you're right, there are other ideas that people have used, which is to use Bluetooth-tuned Gaussian Legere beams. Even without any cladding, you know, you just the blue detune goes in the go beam and then you send atoms down the hole in the middle. But we're not doing anything as sophisticated as that.
So when you
S. It's the velocity potential.
Okay.
So if you use so if you write the usual sort of Madelung thing, that's what S is.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the BC. So don't worry about all this complication. I mean, I'm not going to talk about the equations in detail. The only thing to realize is we've got this extra term here. And normally if you've got a uniform beam, of course, this is a constant, and hence it's dull. It just adds something to the chemical potential. But once, of course, you allow E to change spatially, then either in a lattice or in more interesting things from the perspective of this talk, then of course this has got some content to it in terms of influencing what the atoms do. The other thing to say is this E tilde is the field that's scaled by its spatial average. So this thing is something that fluctuates around about unity, and the overall intensity of the field has disappeared into this alpha prime variable. So if the electromagnetic equation field, obviously if the density of the atoms in the fiber is modulated down the length of the fiber, then the susceptibility changes because it's, you know, 1 plus 4 pi times alpha n. And so if the density changes, then the susceptibility changes, and hence the refractive index changes. And so we have an effect on Maxwell's equations. So here we have, we've factored out the dull average bit that's buried in this parameter C bar squared, but then there is something here which depends on the fluctuations away from the mean of the density times something, this is the density scaled by the average, and this is the polarizability times the average density, basically. So again, this is a small parameter. It's typically 10 to the minus 3 or so in realistic circumstances. We're going to assume alpha prime in the other case is about 0.1. That's very sensitive to the laser pi. You can easily make it bigger than one, of course, but we're going to use it in that domain. And this C bar squared thing here is the ratio of the speed of light to the speed of sound in the condensate. So this is a very, very big number. The C bar is about 10 to the 11. So that will also be influential in terms of how we think about things.
So we have.
Beg pardon?
10 to the 11 in what units?
It's dimensionless. It's the ratio of the speed of light to the speed of sound in the condensate.
Oh
yeah, sorry, I should say this is scaled in X is scaled in the units of the coherence length, T is scaled in units based on the chemical potential divided by H bar. So the units, everything you see here is dimensionless actually. So I'm sorry, I should have stressed that. Yeah.
Where exactly does the modulation of your alpha
grow? So alpha is a constant.
Yeah.
That's just the average thing about the polarizability of each atom times the average density. This thing is space and time dependent now. So this will measure the deviations of the condensate from uniformity. So if rho bar, if rho tilde is
so
1...
this just affected, this is basically your index modulation.
That's right, yeah. So the electric field acts through the dipole force in the other case, and the atoms act in the electromagnetic field through the refractive index modulation. Okay. So the values we're assuming, which are pretty typical, this can be varied a lot actually. So this is a rather low power laser, which would probably mean that one would want a fairly wide fiber actually to make sure the dipole force was strong enough to keep things away from the walls. The reason we want this small is it allows us to do calculations, because obviously notice this equation is nonlinear, both E and rho tilde are dynamical variables, and similarly in the last equation it was nonlinear because we had E squared in that equation. So the equation is nonlinear, and if we want to at least have an analytic grip on what's going on, then having a small parameter here is useful. Although of course we already have another small parameter in the shape of 1 over C bar. And these are actually going to give two very different spatial scales in which things happen, because this and this are small, but nowhere near as small as the reciprocal of that. Okay, so those are the assumed values. And I've already just said this. Notice that both the equations are nonlinear in the coupling between, as well, in fact, the hydrodynamic equation is nonlinear in the first place, but they're also, more interestingly, nonlinear in terms of their coupling to the electromagnetic field, and ditto here, this is nonlinear because of that product there. So we're going to linearize things. We're going to look at a linear stability analysis of this problem and see what we find. So let's start off. We're going to initially look at the case where we only have one beam going down the fiber. It's initially unperturbed. It's just a propagating wave, so frequency and wave vector. Then we have some perturbation that we're going to examine, the electromagnetic field. And similarly with the density of the BC, it's 1 plus some time-varying bit. So the interesting thing is now to provide linearized equations for n and epsilon, and then to look at, if you like, the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of those. So the linearized equations look like this. So if one crosses out this term, this coupling term, this is just the wave equation for sound in the BC. So that's very straightforward. The units we've picked, the velocity of sound is 1. So that's straightforward. And again, for the electromagnetic case, we have electromagnetic wave propagating through the average medium if we have no coupling. And then we have some coupling through N here and through epsilon there. Now, let me make a couple of comments about these equations. That actually reminds me of something that I should have put in the slide and I didn't. So here are the equations again. Now, the first thing to note about them is that this factor, E tilde 0, is time and space dependent. And so these are driven coupled equations. They're not just coupled equations. So it's not a polariton, for example, which would be the case where you'd be coupling a light mode to a material mode and the modes cross and they couple and so on. Because here the coupling is actually a driven coupling. And so one expects that therefore life will be not so simple. And in fact, because you have parametric coupling like that, you expect instabilities a bit like what you get with a swing in terms of the parametric oscillator there. So what we expect is regions of k-space where everything is stable in terms of excitations and regions where one may get instabilities and things will blow up and so on. So the game now is to basically look at this in k-space and try and find out which regions we have stable modes in, which are relatively common in the garden, and which modes do we have some instability in. Now, at this point, it's probably good to actually give you a drawing of some picture of what goes on here. In the spirit of democracy, maybe I'll do it on this side. So let's imagine omega and k here. And let's imagine our light wave, which is making our initial beam, has some particular value. Here's k and omega. Now, of course, one then knows, if one is familiar with the idea of Brillouin scattering, that there should be some kinematically allowed process where you have a photon which is backscattered and then a phonon which completes the conservation of energy momentum. So this is a phonon which has got roughly a wave vector of 2k, and this is some Brillouin scattered photon which is roughly minus k with rather small deviations, because obviously the phonon frequency is rather small compared to the frequency of light. So what you might then think is that if one's going to have any instabilities, it may be good to look around this point where one knows there's a degeneracy between an optical lattice photon going like this and a Brillouin scattered photon coming backwards and a phonon going forwards. So as soon as you've got a degeneracy, you anticipate some hybridization, and because it's a driven system, maybe some instabilities. So we are now going to focus on this region. Oh, actually, sorry, I should have said something else as well. The other thing is that clearly there's another kinematically allowed process which doesn't conserve energy, which is this one, like this. So here you would take an optical lattice photon and a phonon. I mean, the scale's very distorted because obviously the speed of light's much bigger, so this is almost vertical compared to that. But you have another phonon here added on to that photon, and that gives you another photon up here. And actually, this is going to be rather relevant when we come to talk about the instability, because if I didn't use this absurd scale where the speed of sound and speed of light were almost comparable, these two points would really be rather close to each other. And so we need to think about that. So if one has that picture in one's mind, then one can, I think, probably see what's about to happen. So where do we expect instability? So this is the kinematic points. There are two places where there's a degeneracy, and we're going to see that both of them are involved. And in fact, the instabilities are sort of coupled in terms of these two points. So what's the physical picture of the instability? Well, let me give you a kind of slightly half-baked version of how, probably many of you know how Brillouin instabilities occur, but let me give you a kind of half-baked version of it. So the idea is the following. You have your optical lattice photon going like this. It generates a backscattered photon, pretty well the same wavelength, and it generates a phonon with twice the wavelength going forward in the forward direction. Now, of course, the density is a real variable, so if you excite phonons going in this direction, it actually forms a kind of diffraction grating because of the modulation of density. And that diffraction grating is exactly the right momentum to backscatter light. And so you get a runaway. You produce phonons and photons. The phonons, in fact, very, very accurately then diffract, again, more optical lattice photons into the backward direction. The interference between the incoming photon and the backscattered photon provides interference pattern of E squared, which is exactly the right sort of optical lattice that agrees with the phonon modulation. And so the whole thing builds on itself and goes from then stability. So that's the crude picture of it. Of course, the question you then want to ask is, on top of those words, what actual scale in K-space does this contaminate? Is it all of it? Is it some small region? Is it symmetric? What scale is it on? And so on. So that's what we will now address. So that's just reiterating the point about the fact that you basically are almost building an optical lattice through this process. Let's now look and see what we actually find. So this is the single beam case, as I said. And this is the real path of the frequencies. And you can see it's quite complicated. So let me try and tell you what's going on here. What we have here is the light mode is basically coming up almost vertically from below, and it disappears off the top. This is one of the two phonon modes then hybridizing with that, i.e. this one here.
What are the axes?
Sorry, this is the real part of omega. The scale, this is 0, this is 5. 1 is the frequency of a phonon with wave vector 1. Okay. Along here we've got Q. These numbers are quite small, so this is 0.00001, so it's 10 to minus 4. So the reason this, where everything happens is so compressed, is basically because all those numbers are small. One of the C-bars is very small. The scale polarizabilities are small. We'll come back towards the end about what the real size of these things are, because that's rather crucial.
It's not the human life?
Sorry, are you...
I'm just asking if it's the scale...
No, it's well. It's been scaled again, actually, to turn it into something multiplied by k, which is useful. Basically, because 2k is pretty well the extent of the Brillouin zone when we come onto the optical lattice, and so that is it's a very natural scale, because we'll find everything happens in the Brillouin zone boundaries and they're coupled in things. So, apologies for changing the rules as we go along, but that's what it is.
The insets
are magnifications of these points. So okay, let me, before I get on to the insets, maybe just say one more thing. So what we have is we have actually three modes out here. The light mode is so vertical you can't see it, but we have two phonon modes, which are basically these two, and we have one mode of light in terms of the light we're scattering into, which pretty well goes up vertically. Out here, these are the two phonons again. This thing is crossing the axis. Again, because the scale is very small, you don't see it till it's way out here. But then in the middle, there is a region where there is only apparently two modes. One is the light mode, which crosses this axis and goes on. And then another mode, which in fact has an imaginary part to it, which is this strange thing here. And the insets are related to bits where these things vary very rapidly, so you can't see it in that scale. So this thing is not, in fact, an abrupt jump, but it's something with a very high curvature. So this is multiplying this scale here by a factor of 10 to the 8. So it really is very, very sharp to see what's going on here. And here we have these two things join onto a third mode like this. And again, this is magnified. This is 10 to 9, actually, times the underlying scale. So it's there's a lot of very fine structure there. And the very fine structure is basically because the 1 over C bar is such a small parameter. But on the other hand, there are things happening, it turns out, in more realistic scales to actually observe in experiments, which is more this scale on which, for example, that instability disappears and you get two propagating modes again. So that's a picture of what happens with the single beam case. And just to say, this was worked out numerically, but one can also use the fact that you have a number of small parameters to actually do pretty good asymptotics, because the parameters are very small in solving the polynomial equations, and you can actually put pretty good bounds. In fact, they probably be pretty well indistinguishable in this curve from the numerical work on what the unstable region for Q is. And the lower one, the one at negative Q, is this thing here, which does not have any reciprocal powers at the speed of light in, or the scale speed of light, and that's why it's visible on this plot. Whereas the upper one, which is this point here, which one has to magnify considerably to see, is got this ratio of the speed of sound to the speed of light reciprocally to the third power, and that's why it's very difficult to see. So, of course, what we'll come back to at the end is that this is the more interesting instability from practical purposes to look at. And the other one probably is the stuff of science fiction rather than reality. So that's the real part. What about the imaginary part? Well, this is the imaginary part. Again, quite stretched out, actually. This is a factor of 10 to the 9 times Q bar. So you can see this is the point where the imaginary part kicks off. It becomes quite large in these units. Remember, the frequency scale was the phonon frequency was 1 for a wave vector, which was equal to the optical lattice wave vector. So this is a very big scale, and that's amplified because there are factors of C bar around, fractional powers of C bar. And then on the other hand, this other instability, which is a long way back on the other side of the Brillouin kinematic point, goes on for a long way. Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand it, but doesn't that mean that especially close to the instability point, everything gets absorbed anyway?
Oh yeah, very very rapidly.
That.
No, but the question is how big is the cavity it's occurring in?
Mm-hmm.
So the K is granular.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you've got a finite system, even if it's only weakly defined by the focusing of the lasers or whatever, and the point is this scale is absolutely minute. So the spatial scale, which is the reciprocal of this, is colossal. I mean, it's kilometers. So this is completely invisible, I think, the allowed K points are, here and then Europe or something. It's miles and miles away.
So that means that your imaginary points at the point where your instability happens already pretty small.
Well, yes, because the reality is it occurs somewhere in this bit.
Okay.
And this bit, the characteristic frequency scale, so the time for it to blow up, is more like a phonon frequency.
Okay.
And of course, what one would like the experimentalists to do is look right at the end point, where it's suddenly all these things are in square roots. Which so there's a bit where it starts off, and if you could explore that, you will find the instability occurring in a scale that you can measure it on. But even out here, it's okay. I mean, phonon frequencies are quite low. But up there, it's unobservable. It's unobservable for various reasons. Okay, and just to, again, give you an impression of where this comes from and why it's big, this is an expression, again, using the kind of asymptotics for what that value of the frequency is. And notice there is a third power of the speed of light over the speed of sound there, and that's why this number is quite large, although there are compensating factors of the polarizability squared. And the reason it's unstable is, of course, that cube root is three roots. One of them is the real root, the thing with the photon that goes up at the top of the last diagram, and the other two are the imaginary, other two complex conjugate imaginary roots like this and this. Okay, so now let's turn away from Brillouin. The original motivation, partly for us looking at this, or one of the motivations, was to try and understand maybe why it's hard to get a BC into a fiber. So one thought was, in the wake of this, is maybe when you try and push it in, one is a picture of just radiation pressure pushing the thing into the fiber, but maybe you get significant Brillouin instabilities, which then disrupt the condensate and make it hard to push in. So that was one thought. And then, of course, the next natural thought is, well, if this thing is basically trying to create an optical lattice by having the backscattered light pretty well infrequent in concert with the forward-going beam, then why not start off with an optical lattice? and then maybe detune one laser compared to another, and that allows you to transport things through maybe in a more stable and more secure manner. So having got these results, we then turn to looking at the optical lattice case. So this is maybe looks like a precursor to an optical lattice. And so is an optical lattice actually stable, or does it suffer from instabilities like this as well? So that's the second part of the talk. Let's see how I'm doing. And my promise didn't seem to work really, does it? I apologize about that. But maybe that's the way these things always are. Okay, so, right, well, let me be a bit faster. So one subtlety about what happens in the optical lattice case, which was this Bill Phillips paper from years and years ago, is you have to be a little bit self-consistent about how you consider the light and the atoms, and if you're inconsistent and you use the unperturbed beams, you get nonsense, so you have to allow the things to relax and so on. Anyway, that doesn't really matter too much for given we're running out of time. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to look, when we have optical beams propagating in both directions, we're going to have a weak static distortion, which if you like is the optical lattice, n naught of x, and then we're going to ask how the previous picture all changes. So let me, with no more ado, go on to a picture of what happens near the center of the zone. So this is a picture, again, this is 10 to the minus 6 in terms of k, so this is a very small fraction of the Riemann zone. We get this sort of funny thing that looks like a bit like a cross-section of a phytoplane or something, which are the blue is the real part. So here, where you get real roots coalescing and one real part coming out, you have the imaginary parts to correlate with that. There is one real root, which is actually quite important, perhaps, which is there. But this root here is complex. And if you blow up this imaginary part, you find underneath that there is another pair of complex roots, which this scale is now 5, this scale is 500. So that red line actually has got underneath it two more complex roots. So what we anticipate then is there's some other instabilities out here that generate this smaller scale structure, and those instabilities are the analogs of the ones which we talked about in the Brillouin case, the one at sufficiently large Q that one might be able to see it. The other thing is this picture is incomplete. There is also another route from the optical spectrum that's a long way down, which is an upturned parabola, and that's actually the conduction band. This whole picture is upside down in a sense. So the excitations, which are higher frequency than the optical lattice, are down the way, and the conduction band is way down here. And what the optical lattice does, it sits at the valence band somewhere here. So there is a picture of an elementary band structure on a much bigger scale, but then all this fine structure of the instabilities on a much smaller scale. So further from the Brillouin zone boundary, so this is more in the observable domain, then we do find another instability that generated these things. Now again, this is a highly magnified vertical scale for the imaginary part. So this instability is the one which one might try and look for experimentally. As one basically took one's cavity and made it longer and longer, one would, or section of fiber, one would anticipate at some point you get an instability. So you'd suddenly find that the losses or whatever you were monitoring would change abruptly at that point. Okay, critical wave vectors, we can write those down. The basic message is they're not that different from the ones before. The big one, the relevant one, is reduced by 1 over root 2. So the thing is stabilized, but only very slightly. Surprisingly, perhaps the other one is not stabilized, but that's the irrelevant one at kilometer scales. So here's the point about the length scale. So this comes back to this point about the granularity of K. So in other words, for this thing to be visible, you really need the length of your fiber in your cavity to be at least as big as pi over QC. And if one tries to estimate that, for the parameters we were talking about, you get something of the order of 10 centimeters, possibly going down to 1 centimeter. The reason we were a little bit constrained by this is that our calculations rely on alpha prime being less than one, and you start to approach one centimeter and one alpha prime gets to one. So the conclusions, so we have a rich set of instabilities in the weak optical lattice. The instability at larger Q may just about be experimentally accessible. And how this picture evolves into the more homogeneous heating that people have looked at, Piazzolla, for example, in strong optical lattices, is something which needs to be understood. So in other words, the picture at the end of the day is that in strong optical lattices, probably this is already going on. It's suppressed for reasons that Piazzolla and his collaborators talked about in their paper about why the heating doesn't completely destroy experiments immediately. But how you migrate from what we're saying in the weak optical lattice along the length scales into this more homogeneous picture for strong lattices is something which remains to be done. So thank you very much, and I apologize for being at least 20 minutes longer than I thought I'd be. Yes.
Two completely unrelated questions. So the first is the instability in without the optical lattice that somehow after what you explained this makes sense. I can imagine how this looks like. But what does the instability in the optical lattice with the optical lattice looks like? What happens?
Well, you get a modulation of the light field. So on top of the ordinary optical lattice, you get some rather long wavelength modulation of the lattice in conjunction with phonons. So the phonons then form, I mean, it's the same sort of thing almost as a real instability again. The phonons modulate the density. That provides a grating. That generates some sidebands, if you like, if you want to think of it that way, on top of the optical lattice itself, or think of some slow modulation in that, and then that blows up on timescales for this large K thing, timescales which are roughly phenon timescales, or less if you're very near the critical point.
Is there, I mean, I guess there's saturation of that too.
You can give a qualitative argument why it never works. Even if you try and saturate that, you'll find there's another one. And it's because somehow, whenever you form a band structure using your optical lattice, all the instabilities just migrate to the new valence band, the new band minimum. And you can still then, you've got two minima, so your band structure of photons is something periodic across the zone. So imagine the two maxima of the valence band at each side of the zone. You can always decay from the top of this minimum, which is the optical lattice, to something there. Mm-hmm. So there's always a kinematically allowed process. The only issue is whether it then disappears out of the length of the system because the Qs get smaller and smaller. So that can save you, but that's about it. So my guess is the next one would be, you know, if you were just bang on the ability to see that one, then maybe the next one wouldn't occur. But we haven't calculated that yet.
So what you are doing is still basically this one-dimensional case, which basically is in the fiber. So how much is that transferable to it?
Oh, I think
it's the optical lattice without fiber around it.
I think it's very difficult to transfer it. I mean, let me say something in our defense about why that is a good thing. Because I understand the thrust of the question. One of the ideas about why the fiber is a nice thing is it's a very protected environment.
Yeah.
So if you want to do experiments where you really need very delicate control of your atoms and light, then it's very good. So it's not irrelevant in that sense. Now, of course, the good thing about it is the spontaneous emission. You've only got discrete modes. You've got great control over that. And that's what lays this bare. Whereas if you go into just mirrors, but nothing stopping you sideways, you go back to ordinary spontaneous emission and back to homogeneous heating. So if you want something which A may be useful because it's in a fiber, and B has some interest from the point of view of well-defined instabilities and everything, then 1D is in this confined geometry is a good thing. Yeah.
I also wonder about the visualization of the scheme. For instance, what about the Dubnoi wavelength of the amps and dimension, the one dimension that we are discussing?
I think Well, again, I guess it depends on quite what you mean, but are you thinking, are you worried about the fact that the initial state in some sense is a de Broglie wavelength, which is the length of the fiber? Because your original thing would just be homogeneous in that scale. Oh, the transverse dimension is of the order of microns.
Yeah.
It's of the order of microns. It can be a bit bigger. It can be up to 10 microns. In the pictures I showed you earlier on, they vary between roughly 1 and roughly 10 microns. I mean, in fact, of course, the bigger it is, the easier it is to make. The difficult ones are the smaller ones.
And what about the growing wavelength?
Well, the idea is you use the dipole force on the due to the light going down the middle of the fiber, you use that to confine the atoms away from the sides. So it will be, you know, somewhat less than the width of the fiber, maybe a factor of 10. It depends on the intensity of the laser and, you know, but roughly that order, so microns, I would say. Tenths of microns to microns. Is that nothing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know there was going to be a consequence to that, but okay. No, thanks.
It may be unrelated, but still it's a medium. Yes, so there is some famous phenomena like Anderson localization one dimension.
Oh, yeah.
Which it's especially kind of. Oh, no, sure. In one
no, you're quite right. Yeah. I think the idea is that in these sort of fiber optic systems, for the people who want to use it just for light, they put a lot of effort into making the fibers as uniform as possible so as to escape any signatures of Anderson localization. So.
If you want to propagate atoms, it should be much worse for atoms.
Well, again, the atoms, remember, are being kept away from the walls.
So, I mean, they don't feel any impurities or...
Well, again, you would probably have it evacuated. If you had it in air, then there'd be lots of scattering. But in reality, you'd probably want it under a fairly high vacuum. And so, of course, there will always be some residual gas atoms and there will be scattering. But that's more, I mean, that's not static, that's more dynamic. And in terms of the smoothness of the walls, so whether the atoms see some fluctuation in the van der Waals potential due to the wall not being quite flat, I think the guys who make these things to actually use them for telecoms and things make them. I mean, that's how they can get 100 kilometer propagation lanes.
No, but it's yeah. For light, not for atoms.
Yeah.
It's a question. For light, it's easier.
No, sure.
Isn't that something which you would kind of expect to be counteracted by those instabilities?
Well, yes, I mean, if there was any localization of the atoms, well, I mean, first of all, of course, one knows that for bosonic atoms, the bosons can screen out this order, so not like fermions. So in fact, in 1D, there is at least some pseudocondensate that occurs if the atoms are dense enough or strongly interacting enough. So that mitigates that a bit compared to what would happen if you're trying to send fermionic atoms down. It's not really superfluidity. I mean, it gives rise to still having superfluidity even in a disordered environment.
No, but it's many body effects. It's only
when you. Oh, no, it's a screening, basically. So if you have some dip in your potential, the condensate wave function gets bigger, and then so the net result each atom sees is a flat potential. That's how it works. I mean, that's all, well, people have looked at that for 20 or 30 years, so that's. Well, I think not in a simple way. No, I think you might want to do it with wave packets if you want to do it, because obviously you make the wave packets short enough. Doesn't matter the length of fiber, you won't see the instability. But then there's the issue about if you send wave packets down, is that really, how do you make the coherence work properly and everything? It's, so, I mean, it may turn into another problem, which may be interesting, yeah?
So, you use the hydrodynamics equation for to model the dynamics.
Oh, yeah.
But at some point, they're going to break down in 1 billion.
Oh, no, of course, there's algebraic order and everything.
Uh-huh.
I'm ignoring that, of course.
But this could affect the results.
I mean, you're right in principle. I mean, the message usually from a lot of experiments is it's actually very hard to detect anything to do with the algebraic order. And you get, you know, to a large extent you can think about it as being like a pseudocondensate and so on. But you're right, I haven't put a number on where that starts to matter compared to these other things.
It's because 1D is quite particularly weird that the lower the density, the stronger interacting it could become.
Yes.
So it's...
So what would your recommendation be?
I would be afraid of using hydrodynamic, but I don't know. So there is one simple case that is when system behave like non-interacting fermions. That
yes.
is another region what you could solve.
I guess the other kind of slightly kind of balancing aspect is what the wave vector scales are here. So, I mean, it's whether. Yeah. Okay. No, I mean, it's a good point. I haven't tried to work that out. I think that in terms of seeing these effects, I mean, obviously, what one would really want to do is probably go to beneath a centimeter and try and do it in a more strong coupling regime. And at that point, I do wonder whether the algebraic order really matters. But you're right, it could be an important thing.